That's right, cultists. In the words of the great man, you've just unlocked this door with the key of imagination. It's the first Tuesday of the month, so it's another cult classic. I hope you came through any April Fool's pranks relatively unscathed, by the way. Pull up a chair or bed or whatever it is to hand and come with us for the next hour and change as we tentatively explore the shadowy extremes of the human experience known as the Twilight Zone. I'm DK, your guide to the fifth dimension. But as usual, I'm not alone. Submitted for your approval, three individuals drawn inexorably to a place and time to discuss their feelings on today's subject. Our first guest today was last seen on our show a little over a year ago, where we discussed the Steven Spielberg comedy 1941, which curiously ties into today's subject of choice. She's a regular on the network, but it's only her second appearance on Cult Classics. It's Adrienne.
Hello, everyone.
How are things with you today?
Things are great out here in Los Angeles, although it is cold, wet, and rainy, which is good. It's going to help us with our fire issue.
Now, you're scheduled for a few appearances over these coming months. You looking forward to it?
I love being here, actually. I love watching these movies and going through them and reliving it all. And sometimes they're new, like 1941 was. So I love being here. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the invite. Oh, anytime. Thank you for joining us. Next up, we have a couple who, curiously, are also joining us for the second time on this one. If you've been with us a while, you may remember they made their first appearance on last season's look at Hammer's Quatermass in the Pit from the Destination Yesterday podcast. It's Neil and Michelle. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
How's life in the third dimension treating you?
Well, it's cold and wet here.
I mean, we're in Sheffield, UK. There is this incredible commonality of experience in that it's cold and wet.
Here and in California.
Yeah. What's happening over at Destination Yesterday? You've recently completed your adaptation of Dagon. How did that go down with the listeners?
It's been going down really well. Our audience over a year has grown tremendously, and the show, I think, is generally well received.
And the epilogues are doing well?
Yep, absolutely. And we've got other plans in the pipeline. Later this year, we will be launching Eyes for Investigate Color Out of Space.
I was going to say, it was a massive undertaking. And if you don't mind me saying, exploded into something, Dagon especially, exploded into something much bigger than you originally planned. I mean, speaking from my experience here, it's difficult enough making sure everything works on a one-person show. But for you guys, with a big, you know, multi-part script and a not inconsiderable cast, how do you stay sane?
We were insane to take it on in the first place.
It was supposed to be a two or three episode gap filler between The Shambler from the Stars and The Colorado Space. But then I decided to, things got going and I thought I could really incorporate The Shadow over Innsmouth, which I did. And suddenly it's
turned into
11 parts, really.
Sprawling monster.
Yes, 11 parts. And it's 10A and 10B because if it could have been one huge thing to put out, it would have been just part 10, but it would have been like 80 minutes long.
Now you've got this experience mostly behind you. Looking back, are you pleased with how it turned out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When you're producing, you don't tend to actually listen back to episodes at all. You just sort of do them, get them out, and then move on to the next one. But I've taken the opportunity to listen back to stuff, and I'm just thinking, wow, this is really good. I wonder who made it.
Now, as I said, you were last on during our Halloween month of monsters for Quatermass in the Pit.
Oh, that was, I love that film.
People thought it was a bit too niche. But actually, it's been one of the most viewed and most well-received episodes we've done. Does that surprise you?
Personally, no, because I've loved it since I was quite young, and I always really enjoy it. There's just something about the possibility of it. It's perfect.
Yeah, so the episode, it's done really well. So I'm putting it down to you guys' presence on that one. So, yeah, I'm going to need you to work that magic again for this episode. As you can hear, we have our players. Now it's time to get down to the game. You've all been here before, so there's no point asking you your favorite cult movies on this one. So with today's movie in mind, I'm going to ask you, when did you first discover The Twilight Zone? Are you fans of the original show, or did you come to it later?
It's always been on my cultural radar as such, but I think I first encountered the series as such, the original Twilight Zone series, in the 1990s. I did it in a roundabout way in that I was aware of the movie first. The movie I probably do know from about 3-4 years after it was actually got its cinema release.
Yeah.
Around 1972, at the age of 8. I had the books, I watched the series, I've just always absolutely adored it. So, I mean, I'm a longtime fan, watched the remake series as well, the movie, obviously, anything Twilight Zone, I'm on it.
Well, I remember seeing it in the theaters, and in my brain, it either came out right after or right before Return of the Jedi. I kind of have these two movies together in my head for around the same time period that I saw them. And then I remember when it came out on VHS, I got it, rented it, and watched it a lot. just because it was so interesting. And then later in life, watched it again, and there's still things that surprise me.
Yeah. Movie aside, which I'll get into shortly, I think my first experience with the franchise was the 80s iteration. They used to show them really late at night on my local ITV station in the UK. Oh, and I would, I just lapped them up. Music by the Grateful Dead, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Though I don't personally think the 80s series has aged all that well. It was many years later that I saw my first episode of the classic series, and I just adore it. I've seen every iteration up to the recent Jordan Peele version a couple of years ago, but nothing compares to the Serling original. I have to say I do consider him one of my idols. I've got the entire series on Blu-ray as well, of like you, Michelle, series of books penned by Serling with his episodes in prose. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, do you guys have a favorite episode? Mine is, I think, I think it was only the second episode, One for the Angels with Ed Wynn. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, that. Yes, that's a brilliant one. Yeah. I like Walking Distance. Part of my problem is remembering titles. There's the one with Burgess Meredith where his glasses break. Yeah.
Time Enough at Last.
Yes. Yeah. I'd have to list too many. I don't think there was ever an episode that I personally would say, oh, that was horrible. It's hard to really say a favorite, except that the ones that really stick in my mind are Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, because I love that message that we are the monsters. We will destroy ourselves if you don't give them half a chance. So I suppose that's my overall favorite.
I did used to watch these a little bit with my grandmother, and still the very first episode is my favorite one, Where Is Everybody? Because it's the first one I saw, and I didn't really understand the show to begin with. Like, what is she talking about? Twilight Zone? I don't get it. And then I got it after this.
What about you, Neil?
I have not been as immersed in the series, I will say, but what I have seen, I do absolutely love. And I did love the Burgess Meredith story. I thought it had such an amazing twist.
But I felt so sorry for him.
You do. And that's the thing. It does call out. A great series for actually A, provoking thought, and B,
emotion.
Yes, exactly. It sort of brings out these emotional responses, because in a half hour show, they manage to make you empathize with the situation so completely, even though it's as fantastical as it is. It's just wow. And that's, I think, why it's so powerful.
Yeah, so we're going to look today at the first real effort to resurrect the series since the 60s, which was 1983's Twilight Zone, the movie. It's listed as a sci-fi horror anthology based on Rod Serling's television series of the same name. Produced by Steven Spielberg and John Landis, it features four stories directed by Landis, Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller, starring an ensemble cast of actors, both new and returning from the original series, featuring such names as Dan Aykroyd, Vic Morrow, John Lithgow, Kevin McCarthy, Kathleen Quinlan, and Scatman Crothers. Landis' segment is an original story created for the film, while the segments by Spielberg, Dante, and Miller are remakes of episodes from the original series. The movie is infamous, we'll get into it shortly, but it's infamous for the tragedy which occurred on set during the filming of Landis' segment, when Vic Morrow and two illegally hired child actors were killed in a helicopter crash. The deaths led to several years of legal action, although no individuals were found to be criminally liable. However, as a result, new procedures and safety standards were imposed in the filmmaking industry. It opened on June the 24th, 1983, and received mixed reviews, with praise directed at Dante and Miller's segments, but criticism towards the segments by Landis and Spielberg. Richard Corliss from Time said, "Want to see something really scary?" asked Dan Aykroyd at the film's end. "The Miller and Dante episodes are, so is the epic waste that informs much of this movie." While the Boston Globe said, "The original TV series was sometimes frightening, sometimes enlightening, and sometimes a bit too allegorical, but it was almost always entertaining. Serling gave us more in 25 minutes than Spielberg and company give us in nearly 2 hours." Now, despite the controversy and mixed reception, it was a commercial success, grossing $42 million on a $10 million budget. Although it wasn't the hit executives were hoping for, but it did create enough interest for CBS to give the go-ahead to the 1980s TV version of the show. Today's movie can be found on both physical and digital formats, depending on your location. Though I will say it's an absolute effing nightmare to get it on Blu-ray in the UK. And that's just from personal experience. So yeah, this was literally my first experience of the franchise. As I said, the 80s revival was the first series I saw, but I came to it through this. I think, like most people, I kind of knew about the Twilight Zone through osmosis more than anything. The iconic theme, the offhand way it was used in any media when I was a child to refer to some kind of strange situation. I don't think it was until around I was 9 or 10 that I saw anything to do with the franchise, and it was because of this movie. I was at a friend's house and they had a copy of, I think it was Starburst magazine, which had a feature on the upcoming movie. It shows some stills from the production, mostly the It's a Wonderful Life segment. I was captivated, really wanted to see it. But it wasn't until a little while later, after it had left the cinemas and been, you know, warming the local video store shelves for a long while, that I finally caught it. And again, I think it was on the ITV station. I didn't warm to it immediately, I have to say. The actual thing never seems to compare with what goes on in your imagination when you build it up. But it has been a semi-regular watch ever since. And as stated, I'm a huge fan of the show itself and Serling. So, how about you guys? You remember the first time you watched this one? And you Adrian, you said that you saw this at the theater. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Movies was a huge part of basically growing up out here, going to see the movies when they come out. And, saw it in the theater. I do remember it. And I do remember being excited when I finally saw it on VHS and I could show people I knew, like, this movie. Like, I got excited, like, because I especially like John Lithgow's performance.
I saw it on TV, and to be fair, being a longtime fan of the, I'd seen every of the black and whites, and I knew the episodes, and I wasn't very pleased. I wasn't very pleased at all, because I can be like that. I can be very, it's not like the original, not as good as the original. They left more to the imagination in the original. Oh, why do they need these icky special effects like that when subtlety is the best? But hey, we'll get on to what I think of the movie now at some point. But yeah, that's what I thought originally. I was not impressed.
Fair enough.
Neil?
It first came onto my radar, and I hate to say this, is because of news reports of...
Oh, Vic Morrow.
Yeah, the what happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it at the cinema. I was too busy prepping for exams. So all my time was focused on that. I was aware of it, but it just didn't really sort of, it wasn't something I was going to go and see. But when it did hit the television screens, yes, definitely, I did watch it, certainly on the first time it was shown, I believe again on ITV. Actually, at the time, it did captivate me. And I think in a way, that's a good thing because it opens the doors to sort of wanting more and therefore seeking out information about the TV series.
Yeah. I do think that with regards to updates, they're not always going to hold up to the original, but it will maybe intrigue a certain portion of that new audience to check out consider superior stuff.
Mm.
Now, you brought up, I mean, we'll get into the writing of the thing at the moment, but you did bring up the tragedy that occurred. So just to fill in those in the audience who don't know what happened. Yeah, during the film of the first Time Out segment, directed by Landis on July the 23rd, 1982, at 2:20 a.m., actor Vic Morrow and child actors Micah Din Lee, who is age 7, and Renee Xin Yi Chen, age 6, died in an accident involving a Bell UH-1 helicopter being used on the set. The two child actors had been hired in violation of California law, which prohibits child actors from working at night or in proximity to explosions, and requires the presence of a teacher or social worker. During the subsequent trial, Landis denied culpability for the accident, but admitted that their hiring was, and I'm using quotation marks here, wrong. Producer and co-director Steven Spielberg was so disgusted by Landis's handling of the situation, he ended their friendship. But yeah, when approached by the press about the accident, Spielberg stated, "No movie is worth dying for." George Miller was so repulsed by the entire scenario, he abandoned post-production of his own segment without announcement, leaving Joe Dante to supervise editing. The scenes involving the child actors were not in Landis's original draft for the segment, but after Warner Brothers executives Lucy Fisher and Terry Semel objected that the central character of the segment was just too unsympathetic, Landis came up with the idea of Morrow's character, Bill O'Connor, redeeming himself by rescuing two Vietnamese orphans. In the scene that served as the revised ending, Bill was to have travelled back through time again and stumbled into a deserted village where he finds the two young children left behind when a US Army helicopter appears and begins shooting at them. Morrow was to take both children under his arms and escape out of the village as the hovering helicopter destroyed it with multiple explosions. The helicopter pilot had trouble navigating through the fireballs created by the pyrotechnics, and a technician on the ground did not know this and detonated two of the pyrotechnic charges very close together. These two explosions caused the low-flying helicopter to spin out of control and crash land on top of Morrow and the two children as they were crossing a small pond away from the village mock-up. All three were killed instantly. Landis has said that the actual ending of the segment was unaffected by the accident. When asked how the film changed from its initial conception after the accident, Landis replied, "The intercutting between the actions of the KKK and American GIs and the Viet Cong and the Nazis became more and more frenetic as Bill tried to protect the children. Finally, the Nazis take the children away to shoot them and load him up onto the train. We decided not to use any footage of the children. It was a very difficult situation. And ultimately, we decided it would be really outrageous to Vic Morrow if we cut it out of the movie completely." Landis has also said, "There are moments in the segment I think work well. When Bill is in the cattle car and he looks back and you see his point of view of the bar going by, I think it's an unsettling image." Now, Micah and Renee were being paid under the table to circumvent California's child labor laws, and Landis opted not to seek a waiver. The casting agents were unaware that the children would be involved in the scene. Associate producer George Falsey Jr. told the parents not to tell any firefighters on set that the children were part of the scene, and they also hid them from a fire safety officer who worked as a welfare worker. A fire safety officer was concerned the blast would cause a crash, but did not tell Landis of his concerns. The accident led to civil and criminal action against the filmmakers, which lasted nearly a decade. Landis, Falsey, production designer Dan Allingham, pilot Darcy Wingo, and explosive specialist Paul Stewart were tried and acquitted on charges of manslaughter in a 9-month trial in 1986 and 87. As a result of the accident, second assistant director Andy House had his name removed from the credits and replaced with the pseudonym Alan Smithy. The incident also resulted in the establishment of the Motion Picture and Entertainment Unit within the Cal Fire Office of the State Fire Marshal to enforce fire safety regulations and requirements in the entertainment industry. Now, director John Landis has never publicly accepted responsibility for the accident and stated that this is a terrible, terrible accident and will cause pain and anguish to all of us for the rest of our lives. I can think of nothing worse than losing a child. The idea that this could be anything other than an unforeseeable accident is not only wrong, it's bewildering. Although Steve Lidecker, a camera operator on board, testified that Landis had earlier shrugged off warnings about the stunt with the comment, "We may lose the helicopter." While Lidecker acknowledged that Landis may have been joking when he made the remark, he also said, "I learned not to take anything the man said as a joke. It was just his attitude. He didn't have time for suggestions from anybody." So, yeah, that was the situation for those of you who didn't know. I didn't know, obviously, the background until much later. Was it a well-known thing in people's minds when you went to see the movie?
When I went to see the movie, I was just a little kid, and I knew there was a tragic accident from the news reports and everything, but I didn't put it together until later that it was this movie because I was just a little kid. Other people knew, and grown-ups knew, and they would say, "Oh, I can't believe they put that part." I remember my friend's dad was saying, "I just can't believe they had that in the, none of the scenes filmed in the water should have even been in the movie."
No. If you watch it, it's kind of hard to disassociate the actual segment from what went on, and it leaves a very sour taste in the mouth. Yeah. I don't know what you guys think with regards to that.
Indeed. Yeah. That the people who hired these children and hid them and such were not held responsible, I find repulsive.
Yeah.
Same here.
I mean, for someone to sit there and just say, this is an unforeseeable accident, but so many procedures were dismissed, as you say, to think that nobody was held criminal responsibility for it at the end of the day is just, to me, pretty obscene.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dante later claimed that after the accident, the studio would probably have shut down the movie, except for the fact that Steven Spielberg was doing one of the episodes and they wanted to have a Steven Spielberg movie. The original plan, he was going to do an adaptation of Monsters on Maple Street, but he ended up deciding to do Kick the Can instead because he wanted a nice story rather than one he originally had planned because... Yes. It involved nighttime filming with children and special effects. And apparently Spielberg no longer had the stomach for it. And some have claimed that Spielberg's heart just wasn't in it anymore by the time filming began. In fact, it's been claimed he pretty much wanted nothing to do with the movie after the incident. But again, he was under contractual obligation to provide a segment and settled on Kick the Can and filmed it in just 6 days. Apparently he was so... deeply affected by the deaths, he just wanted to complete the obligation and get out as quickly as possible. From what I can gather, with regards to the writing, the original idea was apparently to just dramatize one story, but when Spielberg became involved, he suggested that three stories be filmed, one by him, and then he brought in, at the time, his friend was John Landis. Joe Dante at that point was developing Gremlins. They brought him in, and obviously George Miller, known for Mad Max. Dante's been on record as said the stories were all supposed to interconnect. Characters from one were supposed to appear in another, and then again in the wraparound. But they scrapped this idea in favor of Aykroyd simply turning out to be Lithgow's ambulance driver. It seemed the entire production seems incredibly poorly thought out.
I think it was, though, because of the rejigging they did due to the accident and their changed feeling towards the whole thing that those changes occurred.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, one of the ideas for the single narrative turned out to be the script for Miracle Mile, which was released in 1988. It basically stars Anthony Edwards, who is going on a date, I think a first date with someone in LA. He accidentally answers a phone that he's not supposed to and finds out that, in, I believe, in the space of an hour, there's going to be a nuclear strike on LA.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think that would have kind of worked for an episode, but I'm not sure they would have worked for a Twilight Zone movie. I do like the fact that they went into the anthology approach. Obviously,
yes.
Some work better than others, in my opinion. But I know it's hard, but if we kind of draw a line under the tragedy that occurred.
Oh, sure, yeah.
What do you think to the writing of this one?
It is a portmanteau movie, to all intents and purposes, a film made of multiple segments. I love well-handled portmanteau films. If they're kind of overseen well, they can be very, very good. But here, I felt that actually it was very patchy because the four segments were so separate in terms of they were all...
They all had
autonomous
different fields.
Entities.
Yeah.
Yeah, different absolutely.
Field. Nothing that really linked them.
Yeah, indeed.
Unlike, I was telling Neil about, you know, I'm a big James Mason fan, and seeing the ones where, like, something happens aboard a ship with people, and then the ship docks, and we follow a different person, and we get another story, and things like that. It's all linked. The people travel, they meet someone, and then you go on to their story. And that's really cool. I think it's a really good way to do things. This just didn't have the linking.
Yeah. And it didn't have a framing structure that sort of reappears throughout the film, which helps to unify the stories to an extent.
Or even a theme. You could have a theme.
I think you've pretty much hit the nail on the head. I mean, the last anthology that we looked at here on the show was Creepshow last year. Whether you like the film or not, it at least had a structure where all these stories were interlinked by its framing narrative. And it worked in that sense. It loses that cohesion with regards to this because you jump from one story to another. And as you say, they're not really thematically linked. So tonally, I think this is where this movie really falls down. Maybe not the last two segments as such. I think the film starts to pick up in the last half, but tonally, especially with, you know, Spielberg going against the horror grain in response to what happened, tonally, it's just all over the place. It doesn't fit together. I mean, what do you think to this, Adrienne?
Yeah, it's a bit scattered. They all kind of interesting stories one-on-one, but they don't really go together except that the fact that they're in the Twilight Zone movie, they don't go together, but it's cool to watch your favorite segment.
It is. In preparation for this one, rather than watch the movie as a whole, which I always do, I spaced it over four nights and watched each segment one an evening, and it works so much better because you're in that frame of mind that you're watching an episode of The Twilight Zone at that point, and you don't have that tonal whiplash that you do with this, because obviously that first segment, I mean, it's dark. It's not just because of what happened on the production, but it's a dark little story.
It is. His character is so unlikable in the bar, obviously.
It's almost hard to watch that.
It now, is.
As a grown-up and everything that's happening, especially here. It's really hard to watch that right now.
Yeah. That kind of situation with regards to this, limited to the story itself, you wish a few people in real life would stumble upon the Twilight Zone. That's my personal thoughts.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, you go from such a dark story to what is essentially supposed to be a heartwarming story, but it doesn't seem, it doesn't fit. They're trying to label it a horror movie, but it doesn't work in the sense of a horror movie. It doesn't do it for me. It is fluff compared to everything that goes around it.
I appreciate the fluff. I really appreciate it.
No, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm going to get to that. As direction goes, even though Spielberg's heart wasn't in it, I still think that second segment is magical. It's emotional. It has the beats that you want. It has likable characters. There's nobody that you don't like. Even the character that you kind of not supposed to gel with, by the end, you know, when he finally, he's coming around to being young at heart. It always makes me emotional, that story. And it makes me emotional, obviously, the older I get. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's dropped into the middle of these otherworldly segments, one which is just pure darkness and one which is just pure absurd randomness, it doesn't quite work. I think it might have been better had this one been put at the start and things get darker as you go.
Rather than offend people at the start who might feel, oh no, what the heck?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But then I wonder actually if the thinking might have been, well, we've got this really sort of light and pleasant segment. It makes a good antidote to the stuff you've just seen, which is basically, you know, the central character is pretty vile. The sequences themselves are, for a family-oriented movie, quite horrific. It might just have been something to ease the tension.
Well, to be fair, though, it wasn't planned that way anyway. It wasn't what he was supposed to do. So,
there is that point, too.
I mean, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street wouldn't have. It would have fit in better with the whole, well, as DK said, more horror idea of the movie.
Yeah.
That his decision that he wasn't going to do that, that he'd find something nice, which Kick the Can is.
Yeah, and the fact that they pulled that together in 6 days, I just think, for me, it's the most coherent segment of the film.
With regards to the direction, I do like that they all seem to have their own style. You can look at the Kick the Can and you can tell it's kind of got that Spielberg vibe. You look at Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, and I think the direction 20,000 Feet is just phenomenal. I love that. I when you first introduced Lithgow's character and he's in the bathroom of the plane, and you know, there's a series of Dutch angles, disorienting views of the character itself to, you know, create the impression that you're with it. I love that. It's directed really well. I think in Dante's segment, you get glimpses of where his career's going to go. He's almost like a proto Tim Burton. I don't know what you can start with the strange angles in the house and the doors and the you know, you've got a corridor that's in completely black and white. And
yeah, it's what I said to Neil. I said that it's rather Tim Burton.
Yeah, and actually looking at it through that lens, I would absolutely have to agree. I mean, it's like I commented that it's like a proto Beetlejuice.
Yes, it's
for sure. Yeah,
yeah, it reminds me of that where Baldwin and Davis first end up in the afterlife.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly the similar sort of visuals, disorientation, animatronics.
It was Rob Bottin who worked on the sections for It's a Good Life. He was inspired by the Rocky and Bullwinkle segments when Bullwinkle tries to pull a rabbit out of his hat. According to Rob Bottin, Joe Dante told him he was looking for something creepy, but please don't go disgusting like he'd done with The Thing. Do you have any particular favourite segment with regards to direction? Not necessarily story, but the way things are handled? And I'll go to you first, Adrienne. I mean, you said you were a big fan of Kick the Can. Would you say that's your favourite with regards to the direction?
That's my favourite mode. That's where I would want, if I had to watch this over and over, that's the segment I would want to watch. If I was trapped in the Twilight Zone, please send me there. But I think the best one is the fourth segment, you know, based on Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. That's the one I think is done the best.
Definitely. I've got to agree with you there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I would actually tend to agree. They're the ones that appeal the most because they seem to be very coherent. You can see where the story is going in terms of how it's being depicted visually. Direction and screenwriting inevitably, I suppose, go hand in hand. It's the director's duty to actually make or bring the best out of the story that he's been given to work with. Mm-hmm. In both those segments, that really works incredibly well. They both are fluent and coherent. The Nightmare at 20,000 Feet segment, the claustrophobic feel is quite amazing. It's almost point of view from Lithgow's character's perspective. It's, you know, you got the kid with the Polaroid cameras always sticking it in his face and everything. Or somebody who is a white knuckles flyer, as a white knuckles flyer myself, is so magnified. It really brought home that sense of this is terrifying, this is a horrible experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that they left the wife character out. You know, sometimes during those early filmings of stuff, they just have the wife be this little supportive character. And in the original, she's like taking sleeping pills and all this stuff. And I'm going, oh, another drug addicted 60s wife? Is that what we're doing? Yeah, you didn't need anybody else. This needs to be about him and that gremlin, his own issues. You know, he didn't need a wife there. Shatner, yeah. I'm sure. Well, wanted to have a pretty girl on his side.
Well, at one point, Shatner was in consideration to reprise the role, but he had to turn it down to prior commitments, which led to Lithgow getting the role.
Mm-hmm. That would have been interesting.
Yeah. Yes, but have you seen the third rock from the sun with the two of them?
Yes.
Shatner arrives and he's the great leader, and they salute him, and they say, how was your flight? And he said, well, there was something on the wing of the plane. And he says, hey, same thing happened to me.
I love that kind of stuff. I do. I love that.
Well, I mean, he's known for his meticulous preparation. So Lithgow had worked out certain scenes in his airplane seat in conjunction with the lightning outside the window. However, during filming, the crew member in charge of the lightning would activate it too soon or too late, throwing off Lithgow's timing. And apparently he was really annoyed at first, and then later came to value it, seeing that it added to his anxious character as he looked genuinely startled by the lightning. The three that are based on actual episodes, how do you think they hold up to the originals with like regards to the ones that are pretty much based entirely on the originals?
I think they held up well. I watched the last segment. I watched it twice, and then I watched the original twice, and I watched this one twice, and that I think that's the one that sticks with me the most.
Well, the Lithgow one.
Yeah, cool. Lithgow versus Shatner.
I'm in favor of Shatner's because it's a statement on mental health, really. He's just come out of an asylum. It brings up the point of, okay, in this one, they think he's crazy again. You know, we think he's crazy. It's a point of, was he crazy the first time?
Right.
Yeah, indeed.
So, yeah, getting on to the actors in this. There's obviously quite the list. So rather than go through, I'll open the floor to you guys for your thoughts on the performances.
Scatman Crothers is brilliant.
Yeah.
As always,
he's a rainbow. He brings you joy.
Mm-hmm.
He could even bring you again.
Yeah, he could. And he even did that in The Shining for a little while. I mean, the guy's a great actor. Miss him. He was such a part of my childhood, you know. Like, I used to watch the Harlem Globetrotter cartoons and all that stuff out here. He was great. I agree.
Yeah, and inevitably John Lithgow.
Oh, yes, he's a fine actor.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought was brilliant at conveying sort of this sense of a terrified flyer who would rather be off that plane than anything, but he is there and he goes through this experience, and I thought he was phenomenal. Also, I will say from the third segment, I really like Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah,
but I'm a big fan anyway.
Oh, Kevin McCarthy, God, he's
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yes, wonderful.
he's one of my faves too. He's brilliant. But I was so tickled that they had Bill Mumy.
Yeah.
A little cameo there.
So cool.
Yeah.
I thought Kathleen Quinlan was incredible on this watch. I remember her from, of course, the first one, but I just think her subtle face changes through the segment to which she's all trying to be nice. But I think it was noticing the peanut butter on the hamburger that really threw her off her game.
I did like the face she pulled when she was pretending to eat it.
Yeah.
That's acting.
And it's cool to see Nancy Cartwright, you know, acting with her face versus her voice. That was neat.
There was another cameo. I don't know if any of you guys picked up on it. The woman holding the Twilight Zone magazine that was trying to get in the bathroom at the start of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, that was actually Carol Serling, Rod Serling's wife.
That's great.
And I noticed, actually, she was a consultant on it as well.
Yeah. So, with regards to MVPs on this one, are we all going with Scatman Crothers or anybody plumping for Lithgow? Or Vic, actually. I mean, I do think he gives a good performance. It's a shame that this is the last one he's going to be remembered as.
Yeah, that's the problem. And he wasn't really allowed to say as much, it was too much action rather than letting him his proper acting. So no matter how he went, that would have been a sad last performance. Although he was good, like I say, it's just it didn't give him that opportunity to show just how bloody great he was.
Yeah, I think any kind of chance that it would have had him to emote and show a more sympathetic side to the character was tragic, was unfortunately removed because of the material.
And I wouldn't say Scatman Crothers is necessarily better than John Lithgow. It's just Scatman Crothers, he's just such a sweetheart.
He is. Everybody wants him as their uncle. I'm going to have to go with Lithgow, but a special mention to Crothers,
Yeah, chalk and cheese, but you're both good in their ways because of who they are and what they can do.
Yeah.
I'm going to give them a tie because I needed that feeling that I got from Crothers. And you get to know him, who he is and what he does, and he get a little to know about his life. Whereas Lithgow's character is just it's just a roller coaster ride. Like you're just shot off, you're done, you're just you can't get off the train until the end.
Yeah.
I'd like to give an honorable mention to the other residents at Sunnyvale.
Oh,
lovely. I thought they were absolutely wonderful as an ensemble supporting cast. Mm-hmm, they were great. They absolutely lived the roles they were playing. You knew these people.
I do have a soft spot for Mrs. Jack Dempsey in that segment. The one who wants to dance.
Oh, of
course. He says, "Will you dance with me?" He said, "I can't dance."
I remember when I first saw this segment as a kid, and I was so mad at the family that wouldn't take their dad home.
I was heartbroken.
I was like, you have got a station wagon. Put him in it and take him away. I still, watching that, I cried a little because,
It is a very emotional segment.
He wants to go home. He wants to be with them. Take him home for the weekend, please, because now I'm sad. Thanks for ruining it for me. Thanks a lot, you guys.
I do think the production design of this entire movie is extremely well done, from the sets to the animatronics to the special effects. And 83, very early CGI in the opening title sequence. I mean, it's very noticeable these days, but I still think it looks pretty good. I don't know if you noticed, but reflected in the eye, you can see Rod.
You can?
Yeah, if you go back, it's a blink and you'll miss it. As the eyeball is turning, you can see a reflection of Rod Serling in there.
Oh, how neat. Okay. I thought the music fit each one. I loved the music in Kick the Can, to be honest. I loved the music. It was so sweet.
You say it's sweet. It was originally written for Psycho 2 as the theme for Norman Bates. Jerry Goldsmith. This is one of his very best. The tonal changes, unlike the movie, work very well on this. There's some beautiful moments in the score. I mean, Goldsmith, of course, he scored several episodes of the original show. But not only can you hear that in the movie, but you can kind of hear snippets of his later work as well. Again, I'm going back to Nightmare on 20,000 Feet. There's a proto little motif in there, which is Gremlins.
Okay.
I could hear a bit of Star Trek with the motion picture in it.
Exactly.
I heard some Star Trek. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
I mean, I think because of the nature of the production itself and how it was troubled, I honestly think it's one of those few scores that lifts the material that it accompanies. Yeah. If Goldsmith's score wasn't there, I think it would be, or in the hands of someone else, it would be flat, it would be lifeless. I think it's one of the most underrated scores he's done. And I immediately went on eBay after watching it and got it on CD.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was looking through the credits to see who had actually scored the
and what did I say?
Section.
What did I say to you? Yeah, I said you Goldsmith. Said it's Goldsmith.
I had a suspicion that it would be John Williams, and it wasn't. But you know, he'd sort of adapted to that Spielbergian sense of music. For that segment, it really did feel like a John Williams scored piece, and I thought that was impressive. In terms of overall sound design, it's very interesting because it's sort of on the cusp of the era when sound starts becoming big and cinematic. It just is not quite in that era yet, and I think actually it does nonetheless work quite well. I thought the plane sequence in Nightmare at 20,000 Feet was very effective.
Yeah. What about you, Adrian?
Sometimes I walk around the house and do stuff during movies I've seen before, and I notice the very jarring music out of the second segment, which sounds right to me because it's supposed to be. Wait, I've got it mixed up.
You were saying the second. Do you mean the third? Or?
Yeah, the third one is jarring for me.
Yes.
As it should be. Because we're supposed to be thrown off. We're supposed to be down the rabbit hole, as it were.
It's and, very much it ties into there. The animation kind of side of things.
Yeah. I loved the special effects they had in that segment. Oh, yeah. The monster, like, blowing and all that stuff. I thought, like, set the cartoons come to life. I thought that was great.
I do also like the fact that when Anthony was kind of getting a bit worked up towards the end and you saw the lights flashing behind him to show that his powers were manifesting himself, it started playing the sound effects from the arcade machine that it was playing right at the start and getting frustrated.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that. Wow.
It frustrates me because for a lot of the elements, there are some really good elements in, but it comes across as kind of a missed opportunity as a whole, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, I mean, it brings us to the legacy of this thing. And obviously it led to the revival of the TV series, but there had been plans for sequels with more filmmakers doing stories of an anthology format. Unfortunately, they were abandoned after what happened and the lackluster box office performance. But even now, and I can't say it's down to the movie. Any kind of iteration in modern pop culture is more down to the TV series that preceded it rather than the movie itself. I unfortunately, the legacy I think you have of this one is not so much the film but what happened with regards to the film, and I do think it's a shame because there was obviously a lot of creativity and a lot of people bringing their A game to this thing.
It would have been so different though if that hadn't happened, because because also it wouldn't have been Kick the Can, it would have been Monsters Are Due, and everyone would have had that enthusiasm, you know, a bit more, and
I think it would have held together a lot more.
So
I mean, before we move on, is there anything you think that we might have missed, anything you want to bring up but haven't had the opportunity?
Well, I did laugh a little bit with the editing because of the last segment. Because if you watch, Lithgow's hair is super damp and crazy. And then in a couple scenes later, it's like freshly coiffed. So that's something you can look for. I did notice that little thing.
I will say this. In that first segment, the American GIs, there's a mention made of Lieutenant Niedermeyer getting fragged by his own troops. This was the fate given to Niedermeyer in the ending of National Lampoon's Animal House.
Of course, we all remember that guy.
It's a semi sequel, I guess. I don't know. Okay, so I'm gonna throw this open. Is there anything about this movie that does it for you, something that grips you personally, it stands out for you personally. Yeah, it's all over the place, but when it does get it right, it gets it so right.
Yeah.
And really. I will say, because nobody's mentioned it, the opening narration on each segment with Burgess Meredith, it's spot on. Yeah. I love it.
It is, yeah. That's kind of what made it flow easy, because you knew you were going to hear him again and he was going to tell you what was going on. And then you're kind of like have this anticipation.
Yeah. And obviously Rod wasn't Wizard at this point, and I don't think they could have picked anyone better to take over that narrator role. So yeah, what does it for you as regards to this film? Is there anything that kind of makes you want to come back and watch it?
Well, for me, there's some sentimental value because it's so old, and I remember watching it in the before times, and it just sort of takes me back to being that age when I saw it. So it's kind of sentimental, but if I do ever watch it again, I won't watch the first segment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah. Kick the can and the last section. Because to me, Twilight Zone was all about morals, and I really appreciated that. Well, the series bothered to do that, you know, to have something really good to say. Those two segments both seemed good. I mean, the first one does have something to say, but I think I've always been too much heard about Vic Morrow, and I don't want to see that.
It's understandable. What about you, Neil?
Yeah.
For me, watching it now, it's very much a film of its time. You know, just sort of coming out of that era when films were sort of small and low budget, and sort of entering these big budget blockbusters, and now it's more of an exercise in nostalgia. It takes you back to that time when movies were just sort of getting into really big special effects and things like this.
Yeah. So, we've given some of our opinions regarding the movie, but what did you think? Once again, we asked on our socials for your opinions. So before we come to our conclusions, we'll go over to Vian to hear from you. Vian, what did the audience have to say with regards to this one?
Hey DK, looks like the audience was actually pretty quiet on this one, which is kind of surprising considering the popularity and huge success of the original Twilight Zone TV show. So we've only got a little bit of feedback. Tim Hasselden says, the one that Vic Morrow died on, the one with Dan Aykroyd, do you want to see something scary? Michael Wilson, our own Michael Wilson, said, ignoring the awful behind-the-scenes stuff, it seems like such a pointless exercise since the stories they remade are inferior to the originals, and the one new story is, well, crap. KJ Sellers says, I think there's only ever been one story in the entire movie I've liked since childhood. Kick the can. The rest of the movie I could do without. John D. Adams agreed, but the opening and Lithgow make it all worth it. So, can't say this was a popular excursion for our movie fans out here, but hopefully somebody out there enjoyed it, and if anything else, it gives people another reason to revisit the TV show. So, with that, back to you, DK.
Nice one. Some interesting takes there. Thanks for that, Vian. And thanks to those of you who did let us know what you think. As always, if you missed out or have any comments or anything regarding the show, you can still drop us a line on our socials or in the comments below. So now we know how you view this one. It's time to go around here in the studio. And if you've been with us a while, you'll know the score. Pun not intended. Stars out of 5 and final thoughts from everyone here. So we'll come to you first, Michelle. What's your roundup on this one and score out of 5?
I'd have to say 3 out of 5, maybe 3.25, due to the unevenness. And I don't doubt that, I'm sorry, that due to me being a Vic Morrow fan, due to that, I can't feel much more for it than that. But when it's good, it's very good. And when it fails, it really fails.
That's fair enough. I don't think you can get any fairer than that. Neil?
Actually, 3 is the score that I would give it. Again, it comes down to this unevenness. And indeed, I would say that actually where it really scores, it really scores. It's an interesting film of its time, but inevitably the baggage does kind of, it colors your perspective. You shouldn't actually view a film for its context, but unfortunately you're forced to.
That's fair enough. What about you, Adrienne?
I give this movie a 3.5 for the acting. I give them that little extra 0.5, but I agree that it's very uneven. But I do recommend that anyone interested in going into film at all definitely should watch it. If you're a young person and you're interested in film and film history, it's something you should see.
Fair enough. For me, it's a misfire. But it gets so much right and comes so close to nailing it that I've got to say it's an admirable effort, but it just falls short. Coupled with the tragedy in production, as much as I like this, and I do, it leaves a sour taste in the mouth, which is a shame. That first section, it goes so hard and would have worked, say, for what happened. But once you know what happened, you just cannot get that out of your mind while watching, which taints the entire experience. The attempt by Spielberg to come away from that, it's a bit too much of an oversteer for me and feels weak in comparison. Even though it's a good segment, it just dilutes it a bit too much. It does finally find its feet in the last couple of segments, but by then the movie's half over. I can't fault the performances. They're all competent, with Scatman Crothers and John Lithgow being particularly good. There's some beautiful direction in here, and Goldman's score is faultless. But it feels less like a solid whole and more a collection of ill-fitting shapes. So as nostalgic as this makes me feel, ultimately it misses its target. And because of that, I'm going to give it also a 3. So averaging that out gives Twilight Zone the movie a final cult classic score of 3.18 out of 5. I mean, it's not the best score by any stretch of the imagination, but we've had much worse. So I think for everything that's, you know, the, as you say, the baggage that's associated with this, I think it's fairly decent score.
Not horrible.
That's it for us. We hope you've enjoyed your time with us here today. If so, please like and subscribe. We've got some good movies coming up and maybe a few bad, both on our cult classics and on our other movie channels. We've also covered quite a few cult classics over the last couple of years. So if you're new to the show, go and check out the cult classics playlist, and hopefully there'll be something in there that floats your boat. And remember, drop us a line. We're always listening. And again, thank you for joining us. All that's left today is to thank today's guests for stepping through that door to the fifth dimension with me. Neil, Michelle, thank you for coming on this journey with us.
Great fun.
Awesome. What about you, Neil? You had a good time?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always good to take part in these conversations.
Yes.
It's, you know, I really enjoy the opportunity. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes.
Oh, anytime. You're both always welcome. I'll make sure to put the link to Destination Yesterday in the description.
Thank you.
Do you want to give the listeners a little bit of info on, you know, what to expect in general?
Coming later in the year, we're going to have The Color Out of Space, or I is for Investigate The Color Out of Space, which will continue the adventures of the I is for Investigate team. We've always got products coming out the door.
We have readings by various
people who are our Destination Yesterday Presents series.
And one of them will be DK.
Their audio material. They are on Spotify and virtually everybody's favorite pod platform.
Yeah, that, and of course the mini-sodes, a bit of comedy thrown in, and a bit of the epilogues. I don't know how long those epilogues for Dagon will continue, but
if that piques your interest somewhat out there, please do go and check out the show. It really would be worth your while. As I said, link will be in the description. So Adrienne, thank you for coming on here today.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Is there anything you want to draw attention to while you're here? Any socials or anything like that?
I'm sort of hiding from social media, although I want to tell everybody out there in the world that they need to right now go watch The Last Showgirl and see Pamela Anderson in a role that was made for her.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's your latest recommendation then, yeah?
Absolutely. Please do, everyone.
Brilliant. I'll check that out. Well, regards to finding you, the listeners won't have to wait long because you're back with us again next month, isn't that right?
Yeah, I am. I'm glad to do this. I love it. I mean, people are forced to listen to me. It's exciting. Yeah, I have control.
And so, yeah, if you out there want to come with us next month, Adrian and I will be ordering a black olive and chocolate pizza as we, along with our guests, take a look at the aftermath of the Great Tomato War. So please join us for that one. As usual, Tuesday of the month. We hope to see you then. Until then, remember...
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
You have been listening to The Cult Classic Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady Vienne. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network. Copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.